Welcome to Defense Unicorns, a podcast for mission-focused innovators. We educate, inform, and provide mission heroes with DevSecOps, cybersecurity, and organizational transformation stories from the world's leading problem solvers. I'm your host, Rob Slaughter, and we're excited for you to join us on this journey. Welcome to today's show. Today we have Nick Chalon, the former Chief Software Officer of the Air Force and the founder of Ask Sage. Nick, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you are without a doubt one of the most well-known people in the Department of Defense space, especially for those folks on LinkedIn. And a lot of people know you for your time in the Air Force as the Chief Software Officer. But I wanted to actually get us started a little bit with a time period that I don't think people are as familiar with, which is really like the activities and the businesses that you started in your early developer years before you actually came here to the US. So I'd love to hear in your own words, what attracted you to software engineering and when did you start becoming a developer yourself?
Yeah, it's pretty difficult when you're from France because it's pretty obvious for Americans that when you learn coding, everything is in English, particularly back then. So I started coding at 7. I didn't speak English whatsoever. I still don't, pretty much. So you can imagine how bad it was back then. And really, I had a tough time because all of the books were in English. So I had to pretty much get the books, read the code, and try to guess what they were trying to tell me. So that was a lot of fun. And then kept doing that for many years. I created my first game. I was 12. And I made 50K from that, which was awesome back then. And that's the money I used to create my first company when I was 15. And when I was 14, I was part of the team that helped create PHP, the programming language. And so we were part of this very first movement of open source back then. And it was very new for everybody. No one really understood it. Most people still don't. And that was a lot of fun. And I always had a passion to create and build new cool things. And that started back then and never stopped.
So you said you started your first video game when you were 12 years old?
Yeah, that's right.
That's amazing. What was the game?
Yeah, so I had the first game where based on your answer, so it was an educational game because somehow I believed learning was fun. And so I had, it's not too common here, Tintin, the character, the cartoon character in Europe is massive. It's huge. It's probably the most well-known cartoon character in Europe, and seen as a whole series of books, and they had made back then some sort of Q&A questions and multiple choice answers on many topics from science to math to whatever. It was paper based, and so I thought, hey, what if I take this and I make it a game, but more importantly, the story of the game would change based on your answer. So if you do good, you take shortcuts and you move faster. But then if you make mistakes, you get more questions, more struggle. And so it was the first game where you had multiple paths and multiple avenues to get where you need to go to based on the quality of your answers.
Yeah, that's incredible. So that's for sure ahead of its time. 50K to a 12-year-old must have felt like a fortune, but especially at that time. But
yeah, that's a lot of money for now. It's also funny because the team I sold it to, right, the editors of that cartoon, and they didn't believe me that I was the one that made the game. They're like, you need 20 people to do this. You didn't do it. So where did you get it from? And so I had voices right in the game. So I had my stepmom and my dad and my grandma, whoever, do different voices. I was doing one of the voices. It's just a lot of fun.
If we find any loose copies around, we'd love to inbox it for you.
I wish I still had one. And back then I was running on Windows 3.1. So the biggest issue would be to run it on modern compute. But
We could probably hook it up to some DoD system. And
that's probably true, actually.
So you took the 50K and then you mentioned just a couple years later, you started another company when you were still a teen. What was that first company?
The company was to bring PHP to enterprises. And so we were creating this new language, a lot of momentum, a lot of companies moving to adopt it. And that was also the time where e-commerce was showing up. And I was the first one to bring SSL back then to Europe and to banks. And so I sold PHP secure modules to the banks. And so we were building a ton of e-commerce websites. Back then, you had no no ability to easily deploy an e-commerce site. So you had to pay quite a bit of money to stand this up. And so we made it what would be a GoDaddy nowadays. But also we had a games server hosting company back then. Of course, Counter-Strike and all these games were booming. And hosting was still super expensive. And so because we got into the hosting of servers back then for PHP, we also decided to do it for gaming. And of course, I was using it myself to have some fun.
So you said around 14, 15 at the time?
Yeah, I was 15 and a half, exactly.
And a half. Those halves are important this time.
Yeah. Back then, it's a big deal.
Yeah. So just from a context perspective, were you at this point, you're running a company, are you still going to school?
Yeah. So I don't know if you can call that going to school, but I was attending high school. I had already 200 people. And so you can imagine you cannot drive because in France you have to be 18. A lot of impediments in your way. My first hire was a very nice lady that was my EA. And she was 57 something and she quit after 3 weeks. She's like, I can't do it. You're like my grandson. I can't do this. And so it was tough, right? To find how do you balance people, getting them excited to go to work, creating a nice culture, but also getting stuff done. And so I was never too good at managing people anyways. But even back then, even if I was good, the age difference was just drastic. And so that was a massive impediment. And so it was tough. And I was still going to school, but then after 6 months, we finished mostly virtually and got my high school diploma and moved on and never went to school ever again.
So before you finished high school, you had started a company with what sounds like 200 people.
Yeah. When I got my high school degree, I guess we were 450 people in 12 countries. So we had offices in Dubai, Latin America, 3 in the US, 1 in Canada. And then we have 7 in Europe. So we had also kind of a clash of cultures. And my English was still not very good, other than coding. And it was always interesting to try to see how do you manage people and how do you grow this stuff. And the culture difference is massive. It's way more than people think. Although being from France, it's such a very hard market and country to be an entrepreneur from, that if you succeed in France, you can succeed pretty much anywhere else, because it's probably the hardest of all the markets that I know of. And so that was one of the good thing for me, was to have that experience in France first and then grow to other nations. So
that's incredible. So but that wasn't obviously your last company. So did that company end up selling or get acquired? And what did you end up doing after that?
Yeah. We sold it to a French company that nobody would know here. And it's one of those kind of service play. We had some IP with all this e-commerce stuff and all this. We had a CMS, a content management system that we had built to build websites with baked-in security and all the stuff we talk about nowadays. Although very different technology landscape back then, obviously, but still pretty good stuff. Linux, PHP, MySQL, all that good stuff. So a lot of fun. And I guess, I ended up founding a total of 13 companies over 23 years. Took, of course, a big stop when I joined the government for 5 years. So already 18 years of being an entrepreneur, 13 companies, 187 products that we sold to 45 Fortune 500. So my skill was to build products to life, to exit within 8 to 12 months on average. And so we were a machine of innovation, and having all these countries for sales, we were able to test markets and get feedback rapidly and price points and see what would stick in each of these markets. And I was only focused on B2B, business to business products. And so we were very good at first taking an idea to a prototype, to a product, to sales, demonstrate revenue, and then sell it to a Fortune 500 or whatever that would take it and run with it. Because I never really loved scaling the business. It get boring at some point for me. That's just who I am. But so we left some money on the table for sure, not taking some of that stuff to bigger, brighter opportunities, but it's still a lot of fun.
So at what point did you start initially visiting the US?
Yeah, I started pretty early coming to our office in New York on Fifth Avenue, and that kind of changed my life. Just had an office in Chicago and LA, but I never had the feeling I got when I went to New York. New York is a very special place, particularly back then, very interesting place. And you show up from cities in France where you have five-story buildings top, right? And so obviously complete difference of culture too. I was struggling in France. I was a workaholic, working 24/7 and never taking vacation. I think I took 27 days in 14 years of vacation back then. Pretty insane. I'm not saying it's healthy, by the way. I'm just saying that's what I did. And so New York was a perfect fit for me. Meanwhile, you had employees in France complaining they had a pimple on the back of their hand and taking 2 weeks off to recover. So it's just a very different way of thinking and doing business.
So at what point from visiting New York did you decide that you wanted to actually become a U.S. citizen?
Yeah, I felt home the minute I got there. And so for me, the first step was not so much about citizenship. It was like, hey, I'm going to leave here and I'm going to move. And so I proposed to the employees of my company that were in France that we would move the HQ to the U.S. And there was a few factors, right? One for sure was the taxes. The tax rate was 75%. So you can imagine when you make millions and you're paying quite a bit of taxes and you're working pretty much 8 months out of the year for the country, which is a little bit too much for my taste. I had a tough time with that after 10 years or so. I felt I paid enough for many lifetimes. And so that was one factor for sure. And then, of course, there was also the culture and just the benefit and the bigger opportunities and the American dream. And it was just a better fit for me as a human. I just felt I was born here. I wasn't, but I should have been maybe. And so very rapidly, we started to do what I had to do to first get a visa, which cost me pretty much $1 million to do that. What we call an investor visa. Now you can just come in from the border and get in, but back then they wouldn't let you do that. So I did it legally, obviously, and did it right. And so that was my first step in moving here. And I proposed to the employees to come here, and out of hundreds of people, what's pretty mind-boggling is in France, when you move, one of the employees found out that you're entitled to 3 year unemployment, first year at 90%, second at 80% or whatever. So you pretty much get your full pay for 3 years. And so out of hundreds of people, not even one decided to move to the U.S. with me, despite us paying all the cost and everything. And most of the employees were pretty young. I understand when you have kids and stuff, it's a pretty big, difficult move and whatever. But most of the team was pretty young, and yet not even one decided to move. And most of those guys decided to wait 2.5 years before looking for a job again. That just tells you the culture of socialism. And when you have too much help from the state, you end up in that nonsense situation. And it was very disappointing for me. And that was a tough time for me to bounce from that. And so we pretty much at that point really decided to say, okay, you know what? We're just going to build this stuff here in the U.S. and grow an American team.
So you moved the company, you had zero employees. You're basically starting from scratch from a team perspective.
We had a few American employees that we already had, but yeah, we lost the chunk of the French business. So that was tough.
How long did it get you to get up and running from that company? And ultimately, I'm assuming you exited from that one as well?
Yeah, we exited. In fact, that's when I decided to exit that one in France. And so that way we built a whole new concept and started with a whole brand new idea. We felt it was just the right time to do it. Also, what was crazy is that the French government expects you to pay 50% of these 3 year unemployment when you move a company to another nation, which is, again, completely insane. And so the cost of that was nuts. So yeah, it felt like it was the right time to really move and not look back.
So how long after moving here did you start getting the urge to actually join the government? It's definitely not your typical story to have an entrepreneur mind starting these companies, obviously be successful, and then out of nowhere, decide to go work for the government.
Yeah, the trigger was pretty simple. It was during the ISIS attacks And I knew a couple of people that got killed in Paris. And I felt, okay, I'm doing freaking mobile apps and fun stuff, but am I really making an impact and really doing what I could be doing to help there? And so my first step was to, I started reaching out to people, and I realized pretty quickly, hey, you cannot do anything if you're not a US citizen. So I was talking to DHS, helping DHS. But again, they said, we can't bring you in until you're a US citizen. I was lucky to be married to an American, so that fast-tracked my citizenship process down to 5 years, which is still pretty long. Between the time of the ISIS attack and me getting my citizenship was a year. And funny enough, I got my citizenship almost on my birthday in August, seven years ago. And so it was perfect timing because a month later, I was already in the job at DHS as the chief architect and special advisor for cyber. So that was very fast.
So that first job at DHS with the cyber focus, like what was your focus? What was your charge? What did you view your role as?
Yeah, DHS is a tough beast. Very siloed, a lot of components. DoD is pretty much the same, but it might be even worse at DHS. I was in charge of all the critical infrastructure and all the cyber architecture that we were building. I was the first one to push Zero Trust back then. So that was like 2017, I believe. And 2016, actually. Yeah, 2016. That was pretty early. Most people didn't even know what it is. They still don't know what it is now. But the goal was to bring this baked-in security and protect critical infrastructure when it comes to attacks, particularly on the grid, water supplies, all of that kind of stuff. And when I started to do my assessments, audits of a lot of these locations with all the state and local partners, and what I saw changed my life. That's where I realized what we see inside of the movies of all the TV shows we love to watch and CIS and whatever else you watch is all that. And the government has pretty much zero access to technology whatsoever. And we're stuck in the 50s. And that was a pretty big awakening moment for me. And that's the first time I went to buy a few generators for my house.
So after you're doing these assessments, you're looking at infrastructure, domestic infrastructure. At what point does the Department of Defense and some of the interactions you had started to have, even while you're at DHS, start to begin?
Yeah, so we had interactions with DoD, of course. But DoD for me was such a crazy beast, right? As a French guy, I was like, I'm never going to be able to help there, right? The chance of this working out is if you already tell people you're going to be at DHS, being born in France and stuff, people wouldn't believe you. Literally a month after having a citizenship, right? Already pretty tough. But I started to realize that, well, first there was an administration change, right? So President Trump came in, I started with Obama. But right when I started, that's when Trump, so I started in September and January, Trump was inaugurated the year. So it was a few months. Of course, complete change of my leadership, complete change of everything. And that was surprising. I knew nothing about the government. I didn't even understand, why do we have contractors? What do we have civilians? What's an SCS? I don't care what that is. What is this, right? We're people. And I had a very tough time trying to understand the differences and why it mattered. And so I was dropped in this with zero training, zero understanding of the government. And now your entire leadership is changing. And the issue we had, particularly at DHS, the appointees were very poor quality, mostly because people didn't want to work for Trump. And so we ended up really having Team F running the show. And that was a tough time, right? Because they had no clue what was going on. And so it was very tough to get stuff done. There was a lot of discussions to do nothing. And so that's where I had an 18 months appointment. My term ended. And so I created my 12th company after leaving DA, which was a cyber assessment product that I sold to Qualys, the publicly traded company in cyber. And 4 months in, after the sale, I went to Qualys as a CTO, and I got a call from Dr. Duchak, who was at OSD ANS, to come and see if I could help with DevSecOps and cyber, which again, no one even knew what DevSecOps was. And so that was super interesting. And so I left and I lost a lot of the vesting I was supposed to get from my exit. And I took the job at OSD.
What drew you to back into the government? What drew you back into the DOD?
I couldn't say no. It's just like that kind of stuff where I could see that I could make a big impact. I was not really empowered to make it on the first go. So I was a little bit bitter about it. I did some good stuff, but compared to what we did in DOD, and thanks to people like you, by the way, but I think we were able to do a lot of pretty cool stuff. And DHS was not as successful. So I was like, damn, we need to do better than this. And so I said, I can't say no to an offer like this, reporting to the Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment. And they had created this dedicated DevSecOps role. And we knew that velocity and innovation was so important and removing the bottlenecks and getting stuff done. That was just too good to say no to that. And so they said, come see us at the Pentagon. Did a couple of meetings. And then I was again dropped on the hot seat with zero training. And it's compounding the issue because, again, now you end up not just with civilian contractors and SESs, but also the whole military side of it with zero understanding of rank or anything that's going on. And that was a big culture shock for me.
Yeah. So you had a hard time treating the colonels and generals any differently than everybody else?
I never do that anyways, even now. For me, it's really also, I remember the first meeting. I'm going to tell you a fun story, but you can't repeat it, okay? So we had this first meeting. So they were doing an agile study, right? We do so many studies. We love that at the Pentagon. So they had this agile study, right? And I show up to this meeting room. First, I had never seen a meeting room with so many seats in my life. We tend not to want to waste that much human resources on the commercial side in wasteful meetings, but we do pretty well in the Pentagon with that. And so we have this typical room where you have the big conference table. And then you have a whole side along the wall with a whole bunch of other seats for people that are allegedly less important that probably know better than the people at the table about the topic, but they can't sit at the table. And so I was at the table and very first meeting in the building. I don't know anybody. I show up, someone introduces me or whatever. And I start hearing people talk about agile and white matters. But I could tell it was buzzwords and really no one understood agile. And agile was 20 years old already at that point. I'm like, what's going on here? There's nothing new here. We don't even have to study this. This is just well understood. There's nothing to study. And so I ask a stupid question. I say, who here has even used agile in their lives on a real project? And out of probably 75 people, two people, me and somebody else, raised their hands. And I was like, so what are you doing here? Why are you here? How can you speak about the topic if you don't understand it? And that was a great way to build a good relationship with all these people that ended up working with me for the next 3 years.
So what you're saying is you were always well-liked.
Yeah, day one. That was a day one good start. But I think everybody knew I was not wrong, but I guess there might be a better way to say it. And look, those people were trying to do their best, and I get it. But the fact is, it's not like the topic was very innovative and unique. It's not like something difficult to talk about. And so I was confused as to why we have 75 people talk about stuff they have never done before. And they are supposed to be the one writing recommendations to the warfighters as to how to do it themselves. And I'm like, you don't even know how to do it yourself. So how are you going to tell people how to do it? So it was just very confusing to me. The whole first experience was like going from like building companies and products in months and weeks and selling them to we're going to do a study with people about a topic that's well known. And oh, by the way, the people participating in the study have no clue about the topic. So very interesting.
Yeah. So at what point did you start talking to different software groups? At what point did you get the idea behind the DevSecOps reference design? Like really after that first meeting, where did you go next?
Yeah, I tried to do my best to start reaching out. And again, I had no one to help me point me to the right directions in terms of what was happening. And I realized, by the way, we have no clue who is doing what and how to share any kind of insight. So my first thought was, hey, one, we need to make this official. We're going to call it the DOD Enterprise DevSecOps Initiative. We're going to do a committee of practice, which, by the way, ended up being the largest committee of practice in the department. across all the services and fourth estate. And so we really did, I think, a pretty good job, despite one, me as a human, two, me as a, with my accent, and three, the fact that I'm not too good with people. We did a good job at bringing everybody at the table and start to reach out to teams. And started, of course, with the obvious, the Casa Runs of the World. You were starting to do some cool stuff with the Space Camp and so on. There was a lot of activity, a lot of redundant activity too. It's okay. But you also want to, we don't have enough talent. So you want to make sure we are using those people wisely. And I never cared about ranks or anything. So for me, it was like, hey, just bring whoever that knows the top. I care about experience and expertise. I couldn't care about rank or degrees. And so that was a great way to start building a coalition. I had already met Lauren from the Air Force. And so that was, she ended up being the CIO after a while. So we had built a pretty good team to start engaging and got some pretty decent feedback. And the first step for me was to say, okay, let's do some reference architecture to at least produce something. But I never care about paperware or paperweight. But the reason why I wanted to do it is because, one, I wanted to make something that sticks. And two, I wanted to then build an enterprise capability around it where each of these software teams don't have to build their own software factory in a vacuum and instead can piggyback on an enterprise offering that would accelerate their adoption. And so that was, I knew I had to have some foundation of something to get there. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, one of the things that really stood out to me is when you released that first version, and maybe it was even a draft version of the DevSecOps reference design, I didn't know you at the time, and I think you did it on LinkedIn. I was amazed at the response and traction it got across the community. When you were working on it and did that initial release, and even when you posted about it, were you anticipating that type of response?
Well, and I knew first I had a pretty big pushback, and there was this massive fight between two communities with the Cloud Foundry Pivotal/VMware legacy teams, which I knew was going to die because I'm very good at understanding where the market is going. And so I knew that was a problem, and I knew how much money we were spending. The Air Force was spending $100 million, a fifth of the revenue of the entire company was given by the Air Force to Pivotal. And I knew that was not healthy. And then we were pushing this Kubernetes open source, fully agnostic, widely diverse community across cloud providers, agnostic. I really believe that was the right thing for the taxpayer and for the warfighter to have options and diversity of options. And so because we push a pretty cool tech stack, and that's what I'm pretty good at, it's knowing where the market is. And so we built this full enterprise DevSecOps vision that was based and grounded on truth, and really people could see that and see where this was headed. And so I think that's why we got some attraction, but also because we brought everybody together. And look, some people didn't want to participate, or everybody has their own reason to be worried about sharing or worried to be having this guy showing up and trying to disrupt some of the work they're doing, right? And trying to control, or trying to limit what they're doing. For good or bad reasons, they don't know. And so it's always tricky to manage this relationship. But I think we did a pretty good job. And yeah, I was happy to see. But I can tell you, it's people like you that really helped us get this in front of everybody. Because there's probably two or three people in the department that had the network that you had, to down to the enlisted, to the people doing the work, regardless of rank. And really, you were able to spread that across this software community like nobody else could. And so I was lucky. I was lucky to meet people like you, people like Jeff McCoy, Matt Houston, Lauren, a bunch of others, of course. But they became the foundation of this movement. And it was tough for me to meet enlisted, because people are afraid of SES, and they, for some reason, people don't want to reach out. I would always tell people, just email me directly. And then the leadership was like, no, you have to go through me first. And that just create massive amount of bottlenecks. And so I convinced people to do it anyways. And we started to build some pretty good momentum.
Yeah, I would love to actually talk a little bit about that from a rank structure perspective, given your past experience. Obviously, rank and that type of hierarchy has a place in the military, but certainly from an innovation and technology perspective, there's definitely some downsides. So I'd love to hear from you on some of the, like, your lessons learned after being in the military, or at least serving in the military, both at the DoD and the Air Force level, on the pros and cons to that type of structure.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? Because I understand why the structure exists. And for some and many type of work, you need that structure. Now, when it comes to innovations, when it comes to disrupting and change agents, I always find it funny, right? That people say, hey, we want to have you as a change agent. But then they complain the minute you make some noise. I have yet to see a change agent be successful by not creating some noise and ruffling some feathers. You can't do one without the other. And it's part of the job, I argue. But again, for me to empower the right people based on, and that's where I'm good at, right? I can really judge someone's technical skills in seconds. And so I would know, hey, these guys are just babbling buzzwords. All these guys actually know the stuff and they do it every day. And I would see the Pentagon and the leadership appoints or select different roles based on being material leaders or being of specific ranks with zero background and expertise in the topic, right? You would never see Google say, hey, I'm gonna have some random guy run Google Cloud. And they've never even built a cloud in their basement, right? That's completely insane, particularly because building the cloud for the Department of Defense is actually harder with all the security implications and all the silos and the size of the organization. So again, that compounds the problem. Doing it for someone that's done it before is already difficult enough, but for someone that's never done it, you end up seeing people that just don't know what to do. And they try to do a bunch of tests or throw things at the wall and see what sticks. And you end up wasting 2 or 3 years of bogus testing when someone that's done something similar before would have probably picked a path pretty fast and move forward and get things done much faster. And that's what we need, right? We need expertise over rank, over status. And when we start picking, right, people for Platform One, you know who we picked. A lot of enlisted majors, captains, people that get the job done. And people were a little bit, the leadership was not used to that, but they couldn't say anything when they were seeing the results.
So, but this time, you're still in the DoD, you release the initial drafts of the DevSecOps reference design, but ultimately you decide not to transition from paper to code at the DoD level. You eventually transition from the DoD over to the Air Force and start your DevSecOps enterprise effort, really start building things, once again, not at the DoD, but at the Air Force level. Can you just walk us through what led you to that decision?
Yeah, we were doing very well and the momentum was growing and it was time to put it into action. And honestly, OSD is not really designed to run programs and get stuff done other than policies. And so it made sense when Dr. Roper had met me a few times and he actually came after a meeting with Ms. Lord, who was the Undersecretary of Acquisition and Sustainment. And he took me out to the side and said, hey, come work for the Air Force. We'll create a new role, Chief Software Officer. He came up with a name. It was interesting. I was not too excited at first for two reasons. One is Chief Software Officer as a title does not exist on the commercial side. And I believe that we should stick to what the commercial side is doing. And felt like it was just going to be another silo of a silo. And I didn't like it. But after thinking for once, I realized maybe the government is ahead of its time on this one, because it does make sense to have a role focused on empowering and enabling software teams in an organization to succeed, which is different from a CIO role or a CTO role. So that it made sense. And DevSecOps is becoming this massive enabler and layer of operations / innovation and security. And it makes sense to have an enterprise team leading all that stuff. And so I decided to say yes. And they created this new office and we moved me to the Air Force.
So how much longer after that, from moving over to the Air Force, did you start working with CloudOne and ultimately end up starting Platform One? And how did those initiatives end up starting?
Yeah, I forgot what was the name of CloudOne, CCE. So we obviously, when I started the Air Force, I started to take a deeper look. I already knew a lot of the work being done, but I had to find out a little bit what was happening in cloud. And so I went to Hanscom and met with the team, seeing what the CCE was doing, which was really focused on modernization and migration from legacy to clouds. And that's one avenue, right? It's the least exciting avenue to the cloud, because it's lift and shift and it's not too exciting and it's not really where you're going to see a lot of return on investment, but it is now something you got to do. But I would not see a path, right, to DevSecOps. And I was concerned that because everyone was building their own stuff in a vacuum, not using the cloud offerings of the Air Force. And I was trying to understand why. And then we saw Basecamp and Kobayashi Maru and all these Air Force, Space Force teams do the same. And I had to understand why. And honestly, it's simple, right? The offering was not adapted to what modern software teams would need to do. And so we said, one, CC, that's a terrible name. So we used my LinkedIn and did a post to try to come up with a new name. And that's where the CloudOne name came from. And Dr. Roper loved it. And so we picked CloudOne. And then, okay, we have a cloud layer now. We need a software factory that's going to be the platform team for the software teams. And we came up with Platform One. And that's where you came up with the logo, which was the real birth of Platform One as an exciting thing. Because again, the marketing and the branding and kind of the fact that we were able to go and convince the lawyers and the leadership that the duty would have an official logo with Baby Yoda and the bear and all that, the stuff we have on there is just a proof that the leadership was trying to do things a little bit more a little bit different, right? And more open to breaking the usual bureaucracy of the building. And it was exciting.
Yeah. So along with a variety of other things, you go on to help really provide the strategic vision for Platform One, Cloud One, and a number of organizations. Throughout that time, what are some of the things that you're most proud of?
I think it's having put the those people together. I think that's why it's still stuck to this day. But I think when you look at some of the products we ended up building inside of Platform One between Bus, which is this key DevSecOps capability for software teams to build software on top of and get to a continuous authority to operate, to release software multiple times a day. When you look at some of the work we've done with IronBank to build hardened containers and getting 750 products authorized, initially at least when I was there in the Pentagon, for companies that often never did business with the DoD before, which is pretty cool because we need diversity of options, we need diversity of companies, and we need to expand as much as we can and remove the barrier to entry. All that stuff was pretty amazing, but the fact that it still exists today is pretty cool. It's been 2 years since I've left. I'm not going to lie that the momentum and kind of the vision has died off. In fact, I don't use the IronBank containers for my company because they are so far behind to modern practices. So it's a little bit sad, but there's a lot of value that we were able to build. You look at the software over the update we've done with the U2 flying the jet and putting AI and having the ability to have Kubernetes on there and do software over the update like a Tesla would on the road. You look at some of the work we were able to do with GBSD, part of the nuclear programs, and really accelerate their timelines drastically and saving 100 years of time in 1 year with 27 programs across the Air Force and Space Force. That stuff is a big impact, but I guess I still wish we could have done more.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the things you point to is really a retention issue. And I've always been passionate about making sure that the best minds of the world are working on national security challenges. And as somebody who served for a decent period of time and myself got out, certainly can speak to how many of the people who I had a tremendous amount of respect for was also getting out at the same time. And it always bothered me that these brilliant, talented, mission-driven people would all disperse to these hundreds of different companies. To me, I've always been passionate about making sure that those best minds still continue to work on national security challenges, which isn't always the case. And government and the military obviously need to always have brilliant, passionate people, but they do struggle from a retention standpoint. So I'd love to hear from you on not only some of those impacts, but maybe some ideas you might have on how the Department of Defense can better treat their people and in some cases increase that retention rate.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I think I get the value of retaining people even when they leave as military personnel or civilians to become a contractor. It still brings value. But the fact also, my fear is if we don't have enough of these good people inside of the government itself, then you have issues with conflict of interest and pretty big impediments that are going to show up pretty quick. And then the wrong behavior and the wrong pattern is going to come back. In fact, that's exactly what we've seen with a lot of the Platform One people leaving on the government side. And then you have the loss of culture and the vision of what the government was supposed to be bringing to the table. I love to find a way to retain people also inside of the government service and not just as contractors. It's not easy, right? There's pretty big pay gaps. But what I've seen, and I think you've seen it too, most of the people, some people are leaving because of the money, and I get it, right? But a lot of them are not leaving only because of the money, but also because of frustration or not being empowered or being appreciated or other reasons, right? And so I would think many of those could be easily helped. There's tools we can use to retain, but I think it has to do with the culture of the team and the leadership. And you have the wrong leader and the whole thing falls apart. And then we've seen it, particularly with some bad decisions, hiring decisions on the leadership side, where the whole bottom layer ends up running away because of that toxicity. And that's disappointing.
You really helped spearhead the DevSecOps movement within the Department of Defense at a time to where really just DevOps in general really probably close to 10 years behind. Talking about AI in particular and the Department of Defense and some of the things that you are seeing, what are the similarities and differences between national security adoption of AI compared to national security adoption of DevOps?
I think it's all the same. The same barriers, the same fears, the same a misunderstanding, lack of competency, lack of, you know, understanding of the return on investment, complacency. So it's always the same issues, lack of expertise, a lack of understanding of the benefits, fear of the unknown. I think, of course, AI is more scary for more people because people have that fear of losing control, which is obviously well limited in a DevSecOps use case and quite the opposite to what AI can do. But it's also the return on investment. If you look at velocity, for example, on generative AI, on average, what we see is one person turning into 35 people. Well, you wouldn't see a result like this with any other technologies. You get more outcomes, but you also have a little bit more risk. That's just the world we live in. And unfortunately, too many people still don't realize that sometimes not doing something is actually the most risky decision. And you may not realize it, but you become obsolete. And I was always telling people, I'm not worried so much that China is going to hack us. I'm worried that they're going to stop trying to hack us because they have nothing to steal that would be interesting to them because we can't innovate anymore. And then you're irrelevant to the situation. That's a pretty scary thought. And you don't want to be so complacent and so far behind that you become irrelevant.
What are some of the things from a policy or technology perspective that the DoD should adopt or start using in order to actually be quick adopters of generative AI solutions and generative AI technology?
It's very puzzling for me because I created Ask Sage because I saw the impact of generative AI on my life and I saw the potential. And I'm very good, again, at seeing stuff that most people can't grasp right away. And that's why I was able to do a lot of innovations along the years, because I know where stuff is headed and I can project the future a little bit, at least in the 5-year cycles, and see what's going to happen. And so for me, it was such a game changer. I had, wow, we have to bring this to the Wallfighter. And I knew that if I didn't try to do it, maybe someone was going to do it, but would it be at the scale and velocity that I could do? Probably not. But despite bringing effectively a turnkey capability that would be completely compliant with every regulations, every CUI, cyber piece of paper that we decided to write one day, and checking every single boxes, you still see the leadership and the incompetence of that leadership get in the way of common sense. And despite that, we got 12,000 DoD users daily on Assage using the platform. And you got to wonder, right? That's a bottom-up push. If the leadership didn't get in the way, and with the Space Force, for example, banning generative AI, which again, we created the Space Force as this new shining beacon of digital innovation. Joe Raymond, when we created the Space Force, calling the Space Force as the first digital service in the United States and a new era of innovation. And the first occasion they have to prove it with actions was to adopt generative AI and lead with it. And so I gave them the baby with a full ATO documentation in February of 2023. And yet they decided to ban generative AI, including with a public distro data, which is unheard of. There's never, ever a single technology that was banned by a service like this ever for anything, particularly public distro data. So not even L2 data, which is really mind-boggling. And really, that was such a disappointment. We're letting down the Wallfighters. We had thousands of Space Force users leading the adoption, leading the pack, right? They had the ATO in progress. They were told to stop the ATO, which again makes no sense, because you have a product fully compliant. You have all the documentation. You're about to sign the ATO. And the week before, we tell you now, just shut it off, despite checking all the cyber requirements, allegedly because people are afraid of the cyber risk, although there is none. And they can't point to a single issue that they have seen, because there's no issue. And that's just poor leadership. And then you hear the same people say that they'll be the one telling the Wallfighter what software to use. It's not the Wallfighter that tell them what to bring to the Air Force and Space Force networks. It's the CIO's shops that will decide what we do or don't do. That's just a toxic. We're going back and losing 5 years of progress, killing, by the way, what we created, which I think was also one of my biggest win with the Continuous Authority to Operate, and putting that into the real documentation guidance of the DoD CIO ATO MF process, which was never codified before me, was just used by Lauren and Danny Holzman in some teams, but never well documented to scale this and make it stick. And so I've done that work also that we would have something that can stick. And the Air Force CIO and CIS just decided that we're going to go back to 5-year cycles of ATOs and not do CATOs anymore. That's not only losing all the progress we've made, but it's
across your career as both an entrepreneur and government. You started a couple companies in France. You moved to the US. You went into the government for the first time with DHS, and then went out and started a company, and then and quickly came back, first at the DoD and then at the Air Force side. And then you've started Assage shortly after you left the Air Force. Any comments on your future plans? Do you see a future where you might get back into government?
I don't think we have a choice. We have to go back. At the same time, you have to go back with the right role. It was pretty high up, but that wasn't enough. So you really have to, because if you look at the entire system, the whole system is broken, right? It's not just IT, it's acquisition, it's the relationship with Congress. Congress itself is broken. Term limits, you could find 50 million issues that will become impediments to the success of an innovative team. You have the Pentagon failing 6 years in a row, their budget audits. If you and I did that with our companies, we'll be in jail, by the way. But that's no problem when you lose a few trillion dollars with a T. No big deal. Nothing to see. Keep walking. And so we're going to have to go back. Ideally, it's unfortunately for me, it's going to have to be a different administration. I wish it wasn't political, but the fact is the entire system is political because I ended up really being labeled under Trump, despite having worked also under Obama. You get stamped and I don't think that goes away. And so that's what we have to deal with. And so that 2025 is going to decide what's the art of possible. But if the conditions and the stars align again, I'll be the first to come back.
The last question I have for you is really, what recommendations do you have for the folks in the government, both the senior leaders with budgets and personnel under them, and also the junior members that might have some of those key insights, but might struggle to make the change that they know they're capable of because just simply fact of their rank?
Yeah, I'm going to start with the leadership first. First, I like people to stop asking for more money. We don't have a money problem. We have a waste of money problem. We have there's plenty of money. It's not a money problem. So anyone that shows up and tells me the solution is to get more money, they already should be out and we don't need those people because that's not the problem. We need to go find the money and stop the waste and merge and stop that nonsense. That's number one. Number two, get out of the way and empower your people. If you don't know the topic, that's okay, but surround yourself with the right people, regardless of rank, and really look at expertise and experience over degree and rank. And then number three is learn, and self-learning is so important. There's a reason why material leaders and PMs are already terrible at basic agile. In the department, if you look at the Defense Acquisition University, we have created during my time a curriculum on DevSecOps and agile acquisition, which should be the only way to buy anything on the planet, including hardware, by the way. It's not just a software thing. And created this curriculum, but it's not mandated. They're still mandated to learn the traditional waterfall process. And they're taught not to depend on anybody else and do their own things in vacuums. And then we wonder why enterprise services are not working out. Sure, you're teaching people all the wrong things. And when people try to do some agile work, they really do what are agile for by wrapping agile into nonsensical agile frameworks like SAFe, which are anti-agile, and just effectively mapping words to fancy new terms using exactly the same outdated processes. And so we need to educate people. And we have the training, and it's out there, and it's not rocket science, but we need to do it. And so I was giving an hour a day to my teams to learn, which is super rare. And maybe it doesn't have to be an hour, but I think we need at least 30 minutes, and particularly on the leadership. I would always remember a very senior person in the Air Force today told me something that was mind-boggling to me. He said, we can't really do agile in with weapon systems because if you run too fast, then you're going to fall down and hurt yourself and you're not going to be able to stand back up. And again, that's a complete misunderstanding of agile, right? The goal of small incremental delivery of value is that the delivery is so small and iterative that if you were to fall and fall, you would not hurt yourself because it's small incremental changes with very little impact. And so it's completely the opposite. They assume agility just means doing a bunch of nonsense fast versus controlled speed over chaos, right? And so again, that's just a basic lack of training. And after spending 2 hours with that person myself, I was able to completely change their state of mind. And oh, by the way, that person is the Secretary of the Air Force today. And so it's just a good example of something that could have drastic impact across thousands of programs and is so important. And these are good people. They want to do the right thing, but it's just a massive lack of understanding of basic principles in innovation and software and everything. So learning, self-learning, invest in yourself. People spend so much time watching a bunch of junk. We still have not really taken care of TikTok, but hopefully we get completely rid of this before it kills more brain cells of our people. So that's the leadership side. And of course, for the doers, because let's face it, leadership is not doing much other than talking all day. My hope is that they don't give up, that they see that better times are coming, winds are shifting, There's going to be massive empowerment. There's going to be a complete reverse course on many of the mistakes that were made recently. We've seen already the backfire with the COVID vaccine and what's going on there with people recalling Army members that refuse to take the vaccine and all that stuff. I think that's going to reopen and readjust the momentum. We need the right people to come and serve. We need to empower them. We need to get out of the way. What I will say is what I found is I'm not saying do crazy stuff or do illegal stuff, of course. But the fact is what I see is most of the time you can ask for forgiveness when you try to innovate and you move a little bit fast and without breaking the law, of course. But there's very few laws. It's mostly nonsensical policies and guidance that conflict with each other anyways. No one really knows what's allowed or not allowed. It's all made up. So I would say just do it and ask for forgiveness. If they fire you, we're gonna get you a better opportunity anyways elsewhere. But the fact is they probably won't fire you. People threatened me many times and no one had the courage to do it. So I found that they might say it, they might threaten you. I've yet to see it happen. So just keep pushing.
Thank you for your time today, Nick. Admired your work, both internal to the government as well as external with AskEdge currently. We'll for sure be following your career as you continue to be an entrepreneur, creating all of these amazing companies. And then I've always admired and loved your passion for just truly helping the nation in your own way. And so wanted to say thank you, Nick, for taking time with us on the show.
Thanks for having me. And again, we would not have been able to get the success of CloudOne Platform One and everything we've done without you. Defense Unicorn has been just an incredible success. I'm not going to lie. I knew you were going to be okay, but I was not expecting to see the momentum and really what it seems to me being the most to become the most successful company in the defense industry by far. I can't even think of a company that come any even close to second to what you've been building here, the culture, the vision, the delivery of value. You brought many different open source projects, which most people don't even know how to build, let alone market and grow and sustain. You attracted probably the best talent of the department. Maybe too many, you need to leave some for some of us, by the way. But you really built something incredible. And I know you have good partners and a whole team. But I know also that they will agree that you would not, that the Defense Unicorn wouldn't be there without you. So congratulations to you.
Thank you for that, Nick. I appreciate the advertisement. I'm sure I owe you either a drink or money or something. But
no, it's free today, just for today.
Yeah, thanks for being nice on the show. Most importantly, truly appreciate it, Nick. And for the listeners, if you don't already, please remember to subscribe to the show. And we look forward to some amazing talks ahead. This is your host, Rob Slaughter. Thanks for listening to Defense Unicorns, a podcast. We have amazing guests coming the next couple of episodes, so subscribe now so you get notified when we release new content.